More information on artists, tickets, and the KBOO broadcast of the festival can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Jackson County, Oregon recently faced off with some of the most powerful corporations in the world when local farmers led an effort to ban the growth of GMO crops. But a recently passed state law, first written by the American Legislative Exchange Council, means that, for now, no other municipality in Oregon may do so. Where did the ALEC bill come from, and how was it passed? We take a closer look at ALEC in Oregon with a special report by KBOO's investigative news team on Jackson and Josephine County's GMO bans on Tuesday, June 24th at 5:45, right after the evening news.
The time is 5 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Edgefield Concerts, presenting an evening with Joan Baez and Indigo Girls next Thursday. Both Indigo Girls and Joan Baez are playing full sets. Also presenting Steve Winwood next Saturday. Tickets at edgefieldconcerts.com and Edgefield Box Office on the night of the show. Coming up right now is your locally produced KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a bee die-off today in Eugene points to the use of insecticides as a cause.
A forest fire in southern Oregon expands quickly, with logging slash acting as tinder for the fire.
The Portland Bureau of Transportation prepares for two town hall meetings next week on a proposed street fee for all Portland residents.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 20th, 2014. I'm Theo Burke.
And I'm Liam Delta. Oregon regulators are investigating a major bee die-off in Eugene, another symptom of the decline of native and domesticated populations of bees in Oregon. Residents of a North Eugene apartment complex found sidewalks littered with dead and dying bees Tuesday, a day after trees at the complex had been sprayed with pesticides. An Oregon Department of Agriculture investigator was at the site Wednesday collecting bees, tree leaves, and flowers for testing. The incident comes during National Pollinator Week, so designated by the U.S. Senate to raise awareness that bees, butterflies, and bats are necessary for 90% of flowering plants to reproduce and over a third of the food we eat, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And it comes exactly a year after 50,000 dead bumblebees were found in a Wilsonville Target parking lot, one of three incidents last summer where a Portland-area company misapplied pesticides, killing the pollinators. The Wilsonville die-off, one of the largest recorded nationwide, spurred calls for tighter restriction of pesticides and prompted the Oregon legislature to form a task force to study the problem. The Joint Interim Task Force on Pollinator Health will hold its first meeting at 10:30 a.m. June 30th at the Capitol. It's expected to submit a report to the legislature by October 1st that could recommend legislation for the 2015 session.
The Portland City Council this week delayed a vote on whether to refer a measure to voters on how to spend the new street fee that's scheduled to be voted on by City Council in November. A town hall on the proposed street fees this coming Tuesday has been moved to a ballroom at the Oregon Convention Center because of expected high attendance at the meeting. The town hall will begin at 8 a.m. on Tuesday, and public testimony will be taken throughout this morning. One local resident concerned about the street fees and misspending by the Portland Bureau of Transportation came into KBOO studios to share his concerns.
I'm Patrick Kane, and I don't think there should be a street fee. I think the city of Portland, it's one of the things we hire them to do, is keep the streets up, and they should do it with the money they already have. And I would like very much for Portland Bureau of Transportation to bid and for everybody to see what the private bid is and what the Portland Bureau of Transportation bid is and compare them. I understand PSU did some study on the pavement and found if you seal the cracks, the pavement lasts quite a bit longer. And I think that should be done so that the repair costs a lot less than repaving large amounts or the whole street later.
The two town hall meetings scheduled by the city on the street fee issue will be held next Tuesday and Wednesday, one at the convention center Tuesday morning and one at Kaiser Permanente on Wednesday evening. The city council approved a street fee of $6 per month per residence, but decided to hold off until the final vote when resistance from the business community made it hard to decide on what the monthly street fee for businesses should be.
The Bryant Fire, reported yesterday afternoon east of Klamath Falls, has grown to 800 acres. It's burning in an active logging operation on steep, rugged terrain, and it's spotting in all directions. Gusty winds are predicted for this evening, which could challenge firefighters. The fire is expected to grow today. The Oregon Department of Forestry is leading the firefighting effort on the Bryant Fire. Resources involved so far include two heavy air tankers, two single-engine air tankers, one helicopter, and hand crews. The cause of the fire is under investigation. Part of the reason it spread so fast is because it broke out in an area that's actively being logged, and the logging slash left behind access tinder for the fire.
Oregon State University Extension offices in Columbia County are being inundated with calls by concerned members of the public about infestations of western tent caterpillars. The outbreaks have caused localized, often severe, defoliation of hardwoods in the northern portion of the county. The defoliation has been most noticeable on red alders, cottonwoods, willows, and fruit trees. However, other broadleaf trees and shrubs are also being affected. The western tent caterpillar is a moth native to the Pacific Northwest. Affected areas are conspicuous by the defoliation that has occurred due to larval feeding, and on closer inspection, by the presence of the caterpillars themselves. The caterpillars are often located in or near silken tents they construct within the tree. Outbreaks by this insect are common. Forest Health aerial surveys indicate that the last large outbreak in Northwest Oregon occurred in 2001 to 2002. This year, more than 13,000 acres of aerially observable defoliation have been detected, making this the largest documented outbreak in Oregon in the last two decades. The affected area observed to date extends from north of Rainier to south of Scappoose and west to Clatskanie. Damage has also been reported in areas of southwest Washington. Although some trees may be completely defoliated at this point, long-term damage from western tent caterpillar is usually only minor. Historically, outbreaks have been short-lived, persisting for only 1 to 2 years in a given area due to the combined effects of natural enemies, diseases, and in some cases, adverse weather. Parasitic wasps and a virus have been identified as among the most significant natural control agents of western tent caterpillars and will quickly return outbreak populations to low levels. State officials do not recommend chemical pesticides, but say that biologically based agents can be effective, but only while caterpillars are in the early stages of development.
The Eastmoreland Neighborhood Association has decided to keep their drone grounded for now. Yes, the Eastmoreland neighborhood has a drone. The device was purchased from Amazon and not licensed by the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. Some residents were dismayed to find out that the purchase was made on their behalf without community consultation. The Neighborhood Association president expressed dismay for the unwanted attention the purchase of a drone has brought to the well-off Southeast Portland neighborhood. He says the drone was meant to be used to monitor the Brooklyn rail yard to make sure that Union Pacific uses low-emissions equipment, as agreed upon in a settlement with the Neighborhood Association last year.
And nationally, the U.S. National Park Service is moving to ban drones in the 84 million acres of land and waterways in the nation's 400 national parks. Park superintendents will be required to write new rules to prohibit the use of drones in the parks. Federal officials say that unmanned aircraft annoys visitors, harasses wildlife, and threatens safety. The head of the Park Service says he does not want drones flushing birds from their nests, hovering over rock climbers at high altitudes, or buzzing bighorn sheep. Some drone operators complain that a ban favors some park users over others, and that drone use so far has been without incident. Grand Canyon and Zion National Parks have already changed their rules to ban drones, and some other national parks, such as Yosemite, are considering rule and policy changes to prohibit drones. Congress has directed the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, to write regulations to integrate commercial drones in U.S. airspace by September 15th. By September 2015, the FAA currently bans all commercial drone use in the U.S., and commercial drone operators are challenging the present ban. Unmanned drones can range in size from that of a hummingbird to an airliner, and their technologies are improving rapidly. The Portland Water Bureau announced today that it may reconsider the way it carries out routine water testing of Portland's drinking water. The Water Bureau tests Portland's drinking water around 240 times each month at its own lab using a test called ColiLert 18. The test is approved by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and is an industry standard, according to Robert Vega of the Oregon Public Health Lab. When the Bureau's samples turn up any form of contamination, it forwards those samples to Legacy Emmanuel Medical Center to test for both harmless forms of E. coli and also the deadly strain of E. coli. Legacy Emmanuel has processed 185 tests for the Water Bureau since 2005 and has found the generic form of E. coli about a dozen times, but has never found the deadly strain. The result of the legacy testing includes last month's follow-up tests of two reservoirs at Mount Tabor and a sampling tap at Southeast Salmon and 2nd Avenue after an area-wide boil water notice. The difference between the lab results at Legacy and the lab results at the Water Bureau has led the Bureau to consider dropping the legacy test, although no final determination has been made.
A marijuana petition initiative in Oregon has received the endorsement of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. New Approach Oregon recently managed to get enough signatures for the initiative to appear on the November ballot. The initiative, IP53, would legalize marijuana possession for adults 21 and older and would regulate cultivation and tax sales. The revenue from taxes would go to funding schools, state and local police, drug treatment, and mental health programs. The ACLU has a history of supporting initiatives to decriminalize marijuana use. ACLU attorneys say America's war on marijuana is a waste of billions of dollars every year of taxpayers' money. They also claim the war is racially biased and needlessly ensnares hundreds of thousands of people in our criminal justice system. The ACLU says that resources used for policing marijuana would be better spent investing in communities. For more information about the Oregon Initiative to legalize recreational marijuana, visit newapproachoregon.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for media analysis of the week's top news on Counterspin. Tonight's show features Ross Caputi, a former Marine who served in Iraq and is now a leader of the reparations movement, about what's really going on in Iraq right now. And we'll hear about a court decision in California that takes aim at tenure for public school teachers. Teacher, writer, and activist Brian Jones talks about what tenure really means and what the impact on students will be. At 6, it's Bread and Roses, KBOO's feminist radio collective. The guest tonight is Nicole, a transgender woman who had to live with her secret for a very long time. She will share her story with us and will offer her perspective on how to make this world a better place for all of us. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Anita Johnson speaks with author Edward Wyckoff Williams about black fathers with gay sons. The weekend's weather is sunny and warm. Tomorrow, the first official day of summer, will be sunny with a high of 76. And Sunday that will be the same with a high of 80. 0% chance of rain. In today's Raidcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 32 counts per minute in North Portland with spikes up to 69, 26 counts per minute in Vancouver, Washington. Eugene, Oregon has a count of 35 CPM. And North Vancouver, British Columbia has a current radiation count of 35 counts per minute. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at raidcast.org. Today in history, on June 20th, 1967, boxer Muhammad Ali was convicted for refusing his induction into the military because of his opposition to the war in Vietnam. 2 months earlier, Ali appeared for his scheduled induction into the U.S. Armed Forces and refused 3 times to step forward at the call of his name. On June 20th, Muhammad Ali was convicted in Houston of violating the Selective Service Law by refusing to be drafted. The decision was later overturned by the United States Supreme Court. The quote of the day is from Henry David Thoreau, "It is never too late to give up our prejudices."
It's 5:17. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Believe it or not, one public official has actually stood up to the finagling banksters of Wall Street. 3 years ago, Jed Rakoff, the U.S. District Judge in Manhattan, stunned Citigroup by just saying no to a sweetheart deal it had cut with the Securities and Exchange Commission. The bank had been caught in an egregious case of ripping off customers by selling a mess of investments to them that the bankers knew would go bad. Sure enough, the customers lost $700 million, while Citigroup reaped $160 million from a side bet it made that the investments would indeed be worthless. Yet, even though the SEC had a solid case against the crooks, rather than taking them to court for proper punishment, the agency slapped them on the wrist with a $285 million fine, pocket change for the $14 billion a year bank. As is common in these sweetheart settlements called consent decrees, the SEC didn't even make Citigroup admit that it was guilty of fraud. Such decrees, however, have to be signed by a judge, and Rakoff was asked to rubber stamp this one. He refused. Like most Americans, he's appalled by Washington's coddling of Wall Street's too-big-to-fail, too-big-to-jail banks. So he demanded that the two cozy parties submit proof that this deal had any relationship to justice. Way to go, Jed! But rather than bother with such niceties as truth, Citigroup appealed Rakoff's ruling, and now he is the one being punished. The appeals court reprimanded Rakoff for demanding truth from a Wall Street bank, declaring that it was not in his judicial purview, quote, to demand cold, hard, solid facts. This is Jim Hightower saying, by getting the one guy who stood up slapped down, Citigroup and the SEC are claiming victory. But they actually lost any shred of public respectability they had left, while lifting our esteem for Judge Rakoff higher than ever.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Dozens of protesters chanting, "The U.S. mail is not for sale," are picketing right now outside a local Staples office supply store. Staples has contracted with the U.S. Postal Service to staff post offices installed within their stores. In pilot openings last fall, 82 post offices were launched inside Staples stores with low-paid, non-union, non-postal workers. If the pilots are deemed to be, quote, successful, the USPS plans to open post offices inside every one of the 1,600 Staples stores nationwide beginning this September. Staples workers are not sworn to safeguard the mail, as postal employees are. Organizers say the risk of theft from the mail deposited in a Staples post office is very real. We're joined now live by Greg Margolis of Communities and Postal Workers United at the site of the protest. Greg, what's the scene at the Staples store right now?
Well, it's pretty inspiring. I'd say there are at least 40 or 50 people, maybe more, here outside of the Staples here on 122nd and Gleason, chanting and to save the U.S. Postal Service, our constitutionally mandated postal service that wasn't intended to be for profit, and that's one of the most efficient government agencies that exists, doesn't use any taxpayers' money, and yet they're trying to privatize it. So people are, rightly enraged by what they're trying to do, and people are here to stand up and say we're not going to continue this effort towards privatization by using Staples to have unaccountable and undertrained staff handle the people's mail.
So
postal workers. Yeah.
So ahead. what are the protesters asking for?
Well, asking to stop using Staples and to actually open up some of the centers that have already been closed, the mail delivery centers, et cetera, and stop outsourcing things like trucking of the mail. And, probably the ultimate thing is to take away the 75-year in advance of paying for retired benefits. That is really what's causing a problem with the revenue of the post office.
And what's the response from the passersby?
Say again?
What is the response from the people on the street that are passing by?
Oh, people are very interested. In fact, I've got Jim Falvey here. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it wrong. Falvey here, who just spoke with somebody, and he can probably tell you more. Jim is the president of the National Association of Letter Carriers, Branch 82. And so when you're ready, he could tell you a little bit more about what people are saying.
Okay. Could you put him on the line?
I sure will.
Thank you.
Hello?
Hello. So what does the union have to say about this?
Well, of course, the National Association of Letter Carriers have an interest in this because the privatization of the window services is the first step in, totally privatizing the Postal Service. And, we have over 280,000 letter carriers nationwide that deliver the people's mail every day. So when we turn the mail over to, as the previous gentleman said, undertrained and people who don't have the responsibility that a federal employee has to handle that mail, it's a huge concern to us.
Right.
And so we've joined with the APWU in calling for the national boycott of Staples and their products.
All right. Thank you. Can you put Greg back on the line?
Sure. You bet.
Hello.
Yes, Greg.
Yes.
So are there any other actions planned for today?
Yes, I understand that there's going to be a dramatic action that will take place today. I don't know exactly what that refers to, but I suspect that there's going to be some way to try to get closer to getting the message sent out while we're out here at Staples.
All right. We'll be following up on that. Thank you, Greg.
Okay. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Greg Margolis of Communities and Postal Workers United. He joined us from the downtown Staples store, or rather the one on 122nd Avenue in Portland, where a protest is taking place right now. The protesters have vowed to increase pressure on the postal supply chain until they drop the postal contract. They urge individuals and institutions to boycott Staples.
In a late-night session yesterday, the United States House of Representatives voted to cut off all funds for two of the National Security Agency's most embattled surveillance programs. The first cut is to a specific program engaged in blanket collection and surveillance of the communications data of the American people. The second is a program seeking companies to provide so-called backdoors into hardware and software to give the agency access to communications without the knowledge or consent of end users. On the second front, the House specifically forbids funding for any agency attempt to, quote, mandate or request that a person redesign its product or service to facilitate electronic surveillance, unquote. Both of those funding bans represent a clear reaction against spying behavior revealed from the leaks of Edward Snowden and pushback from U.S. companies whose product sales have suffered as a result. The House vote represents a major shift from the so-called USA Freedom Bill that failed last month and disappointed privacy advocates. The failure of that surveillance reform bill may have directly inspired Thursday night's landslide vote by not going far enough to satisfy legislators seeking to curtail the NSA's most controversial activities.
As 300 U.S. soldiers deployed to Iraq today, analysts on both the right and left have criticized President Obama's decision. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Professor Marjorie Cohn. She wrote this week that President Obama currently stands on a precipice between war and peace in Iraq.
You are arguing for a diplomatic solution to this crisis going on right now. The ISIS group, or as Obama has been calling them recently, ISIL, is a pretty extreme organization. I understand that Al-Qaeda has condemned them as being too violent. What kind of diplomatic relations do you see with this group?
Well, I don't know that it's diplomatic relations with ISIS per se, but the president or the prime minister of Iraq, al-Maliki, is what happened was that after Obama pulled the U.S. troops out of Iraq, he didn't want to. He wanted to keep them there, but Maliki would not give immunity to U.S. troops for any crimes they would commit after seeing evidence of U.S. war crimes in, you know, during the Bush administration. So Obama pulled the troops out, and then since then, Maliki has been cracking down on, he's a Shiite Muslim, and he's been cracking down on Sunni Muslims, torture, rape, arbitrary mass arrests, murder, protesters, leaders assassinated, and that there's a reaction against that, and ISIS has received some support from people, protesters who used to be nonviolent when they were protesters saw that they were being victimized by Maliki. So the tack that Obama is taking, and evidently Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates as well, are to try to get rid of al-Maliki. Now, I don't think this is going to be forcible regime change, at least at this point, because Obama says no boots on the ground for now. He said, period, no boots on the ground. But there are people who are jockeying to prevent Maliki from getting a third term, and one of them is Ahmed Shalabi, who is somebody who was very controversial during Bush's Iraq War. He also supported the systematic purge of Sunnis from government jobs. And then another one of the people who's jockeying to take over from Maliki, if he's replaced, is Bayan Jaber, who is a minister of interior, was a minister of interior in the transitional Iraqi government, and he is alleged to have tortured prisoners when he was in the interior ministry. It doesn't sound like good alternatives, but my feeling is that the United States, who is a permanent member of the Security Council, should propose a resolution that would require an immediate ceasefire and peacekeepers under UN auspices, and also Syria, you know, this ISIS is also based in Syria, and Syria is very, the conflict in Syria is also very closely tied to what's happening in Iraq.
And who is the ISIS group? Are we seeing something like blowback with U.S. support for the armed resistance in Syria, then coming back into Iraq to try to attack the U.S.-supported, or at least initially U.S.-supported Maliki government there?
Yeah, ISIS is a successor to al-Qaeda in Iraq, which didn't even exist before Bush went in and invaded Iraq and changed the regime there, kicked out Saddam Hussein, which was a highly illegal, disastrous, ill-advised war. And, you know, one of the things that that I think is most disturbing is that if you look at the corporate media, the mainstream media, you see Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Bill Kristol, Paul Bremer, all the neoconservatives from the George W. Bush regime, given time to talk on the networks. You know, they're writing op-eds in the opinion pages, blaming Obama for getting, you know, pulling the troops out of Iraq, and of course he had to pull them out of Iraq because Bush had negotiated that agreement. And as I said, after seeing war crimes being committed by U.S. forces in Iraq, the Iraqi government would not extend that status of forces agreement. They would not extend it without giving and give immunity to U.S. soldiers. So, you know, there's a lot of finger pointing, but I'm hopeful that public opinion in this country will be very much against going into Iraq in any way with armed force, which is, as I said, one of the overriding reasons why Obama, that and Putin's deal with Syria, that Obama did not go into Syria with armed force because he was about to. He said he was going to. So I think that it really, you know, people need to contact their Congress, people contact the White House, demonstrate, write in the newspaper, write letters to the editor and op-eds, and say, no, we've been there, done that. We do not want to do that again.
I've been speaking with Professor Marjorie Cohn. She is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Her most recent piece, Obama on the Brink, War or Peace, can be found on the